Greetings. Greetings and salutations and felicitations.
Great salutations to all, whatever greeting you prefer. I'm Marshall Hopkins.
And I'm Michael Stridigakis.
Welcome back to Story Trek. This is our second episode. Woohoo. That was lame. I know. I'm sorry. Woohoo. I don't know.
I'm having a blast here being in self-isolation since I flew into Houston the other day. And I've got 7 days of isolation before I go get tested to ensure that the home in which I'm staying does not get contaminated. In the meanwhile, I'm in a room locked up and I receive my food at the flight of the stairs with a bell ring so I know that it's available.
Wow. So I am on day 13 of my post-Thanksgiving time quarantine. So that's almost done. I've been getting Uber Eats. I've got deliveries of groceries. So I personally just, I mean, this is off topic, but thank you to essential workers.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, seriously. Like, you keep all of us fed. You take the risk. So not related to Star Trek, but we can make it related to Star Trek as needed. You serve the needs of the many.
Exactly.
So thank you all.
Indeed. I cannot stress enough. I mean, there's just the amount of stuff that people are going through right now in order to get to work every day and protect themselves and their own families at home for the benefit of those of us who have to go out, pick up things or prescriptions or food. So thank you.
This week was my pick of what, in terms of Story Trek, we were going to look at and focus on. When I picked this topic, I did not know, I knew that there were quite a few episodes related to this subject. I didn't know there were that many episodes related to this subject. and so just to clarify, so we'll start here and ask, what's your favorite court TV show or courtroom drama, if you like one? Because this week, Story Trek is going to tackle as many of the Star Trek courtroom drama episodes as we possibly can. And of course, this being Story Trek, the focus is on how is this Trek as opposed to any other franchise? Like, technically, the Avengers could do a courtroom drama if they wanted to, but it wouldn't be Trek. So how do we differentiate the two?
One of the things I think that we kind of have to figure out is, what is a trial episode? What are we defining as a trial episode?
That's a good question, because I know that there, when we were making our list, I had considered one from Deep Space Nine called Cardassians. And we kind of dismissed it because it's not really a trial so much as it is a custody hearing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, there are several elements of your standard Star Trek trial episode that don't happen in this one. It's definitely a mystery episode, but less so of a trial episode. And we'll go into why that is.
So when looking on all of these different trial episodes and thinking about them, trying to answer that question, what is a trial episode in Star Trek? Trial episodes and sequences are the most obvious way that Star Trek tries to weigh in on a point of view for a character or, in fact, the universe and philosophy of Star Trek. Like, that is the purpose of these trials, right, for the most part. We have trials that are questions of philosophical and social justice and overt display. We find that something, some moral or some topical issue of the day is, in fact, on trial through the circumstances of the story and the characters. Or we find that these are really episodes where we're questioning the right or wrongness, if you will, of our characters in our story, that we're being asked to judge their behavior and their actions. Also, in this sense, we're uncovering deception of the world around them, or deception within themselves, and also just, and to that point, also understanding of self. Like, those are the two big categories, the big lump categories that I would say all Trek trial episodes fall into.
Totally agree. Yeah, as I'm going through my watch, and I have to confess, I didn't watch all 19 or every scene from all the movies. All the ones that I saw fit into one of those two categories. Absolutely. It's either an opportunity to dissect or discuss or debate something that is kind of a topical issue, either of its time or just generally a human topical issue, or it's seeking a different kind of truth, like an interpersonal truth or a personal truth or something like that. One thing that I wanted to call out to, and this being Story Trek, I just found it remarkable. As I was watching Court Martial, that first episode, So Court Martial is an episode from the original series. Captain Kirk and the ship of the Enterprise, they're going through an ion storm. And at one point during the ion storm, the damage becomes so bad that he has to jettison one of the pods in which one of his crew members is in. That crew member, Ben Finney, is someone who has a past with Kirk. He blames Kirk for having recognized an accident that Finney had caused before it became a huge explosion or destruction. Because of that, Finney was denied promotion, so he could have been the captain of his own ship at one point, but instead he was demoted underneath Kirk. Also, for context, Finney had served as a teacher at the Academy of Kirk, and so there was sort of an age difference between the two that was a dynamic. The story begins where Kirk is accused of murder of Finney because it's suspected that he pressed the jettison pod before it was absolutely necessary to do so. I had to pause it at 15 minutes and 55 seconds in, and that's how you know I paused it right there. And the reason I did that is because I looked at it, and we had so much information in just 15 minutes just thrown at you, but it felt so natural. Mm-hmm. You know, we have everything we know about Ben Finney, everything we know about Kirk, everything we know about the other dynamics. Basically, the entire case, the mystery, is laid out. You see that other captains are already denigrating Kirk or basically kind of criticizing him for this mistake or what's perceived as a mistake, possibly murder.
And one thing that's interesting about the episode, and I know it does throw a lot at you as far as character and situations and scenarios. One of the things, and this is actually a problem I have with this particular episode of all the trial ones, is I don't even know what an ion pod is. I have no idea what that is.
They never quite explained that.
No. And it really kind of strikes me that we're in the midst of a hearing, but I don't understand the stakes of what the situation is. Is there like a dead body in space? Like, what is the circumstances to which Kirk is being tried? I don't understand, other than they explain that he pressed a button before he should have, or he, you know, should have been reasonable to have done so. I don't understand why this one person's life was in Kirk's hands. That's one of my big problems with that episode.
Well, no, I think you have a valid point, because they never really established, because as I was watching it, I thought about, like, wouldn't you have looked for a body before you declared him dead? It's not like bodies just disappear.
I mean, how many episodes of Star Trek did they actually, like, go off and investigate? And they're like, no, someone's not dead. Let's keep looking.
Right.
Finney, he's dead.
Who? Yeah, he's just gone. Yeah. They just accept that. Right. We've never heard of him or seen him before, but apparently he has a whole daughter and everything. The one thing I wanted to praise about it, like I mentioned before, is the first 15 minutes are just killer. Like, they lay out everything, the tenseness of it. Also, shout out to the fact that you have a black man who's in command of the space station where they go to. Nobody bats an eye about it. That's the progressivism of the original series Star Trek. But also, like, and I looked up the credits of it, this is written or co-written by one of the members of the Mankiewicz family, Don Mankiewicz, one of the co-writers, obviously, but the nephew of Herman Mankiewicz, I believe.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. When I say it throws a lot of information at you, I don't mean that in a critical fashion. I mean that it gives you a lot of information about the characters, the murder mystery. By 15 minutes and 55 seconds, Captain Kirk is standing up and saying not guilty.
Yeah.
That's a lot. You just filled in a whole lot of space in just 15 minutes. And that I thought was remarkable in terms of just constructing the story from the beginning.
The issue I had particularly with that episode is I don't understand Finney's results of things. So I guess one thing we didn't mention in the summary is that, again, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this after 50 plus years, if you haven't, well, you know, skip ahead. But the thing I'm getting to is Kirk discovers through an investigation that Finney actually is alive still. And in fact, he's not just alive, but he's still on the Enterprise. And in fact, they evacuate the ship and get everybody off the ship in order to, like, they have this whole thing about heartbeats and being able to isolate heartbeats on the ship, which, you know, they have like this microphone, it looks like, that they kind of play a little twisty game with, the power plug on it or something. And, you know, that isolates, you know, people's heart's beats. Okay, I'll buy that. But I don't understand the point of it, but I get what it's doing. But the thing that I'm surprised about is that Finney is still on the ship. Now, if I faked my own death, I would also have a plan for how I'm going to get off of a ship and live my life afterwards, or whatever you plan to do. What is the end game? I don't understand Finny's end game.
Right.
That's my issue with the episode. A character who we're setting up for the first time, and his daughter, and he's being court-martialed, and we have this, you know, wonderful kind of, you know, old school type of attorney there with Samuel Coghlan is his name?
Samuel T. Coghlan.
Mm-hmm. And after all of that, this guy has faked his death so he can stay on the ship?
Yeah, I mean, if they had just taken a moment to say he suffered from some sort of space madness or something, that would have given so much context, because all he was just a madman. Now, one thing I did notice about Star Trek, and this is something that I've noticed generally as I was looking at these trial episodes, this is a show that is a procedural for procedures that don't exist yet. You know, like, they will spend time going into detail of how they do XYZ thing. It doesn't matter if you understand the words of what they're saying.
Let's move on to TNG and talk about some of what's there. The one that struck out to me that was sort of the most interesting of these is Justice.
Right.
Now, Justice is a very early on Next Generation episode, and obviously very much falls into that Gene Roddenberry has his hands all over it. For those of you who have not seen it, you probably should just watch it to understand why.
But, you know, I'll defend one thing about it. You have to appreciate the audacity of it. This is what Gary Busey thought heaven was in 1988.
Was it? Okay.
I'm joking. I don't know.
This case is about Wesley fell into a garden past a white barrier.
If I recall correctly, I think that they were somehow playing football. I don't know if baseball. He was teaching baseball. That's what it was. Okay.
Yes. They throw a ball and Wesley goes back to catch it and he falls into this like garden. And all of a sudden these guys jog up there in their scantily clad clothing. And all of a sudden, you know, Wesley's like, sorry, I fell into the garden, but whatever. And they're just like, okay, so you admit to it, kid. Yes, I admit to it. Of course I do. Okay, then here's the needle. I'm going to kill you. And they're like, what? The people on this planet are completely flummoxed as to why, you know, I look at that and I think like, that's an absolutely ridiculous thing. Like this episode is really about how in a wonderful, even perfect looking world, we still have this need to penalize people with death by the state. It's a state-administered punishment. And it's clearly about that, except this episode is interesting in that normally we have some alien or one of our cast members who are the judge or, you know, some sort of presider over the case. This one, the judge is actually this alien entity that floats above the planet. And in so many words, Picard is arguing the case for Wesley, especially at the end of the episode, to this god-like creature on behalf of the Federation. And of course, Picard wins because, you know, that's how it works. To me, I was really kind of fascinated because it's not your typical, like, we don't have the very clear, we don't even really have a clear prosecutor. It's just this group of people. And these group of people are arguing this, but we do clearly have a judge in this instance. And it's even interesting that it's mentioned even several times. It's like, Picard, you come from a very powerful people on your ship.
Right.
You exist in the heavens with God. Is the way these people look at it. You can take Wesley at any point away from us. And Picard could, in fact, do that. And in fact, he does try to do that at the end. Mm-hmm. But at first, he actually tries to work through the system with him. This is where Picard, we start seeing Picard the diplomat. We start seeing that aspect of his character come out for really the first time where he's arguing something and winning an argument. He's basically wins the episode by winning the argument.
Well, one take that, and I kind of had an alternate take on it because I did see shades of the anti-death penalty or anti-death penalty stance on it. However, I took it more of being about rigid legal systems, you know, mm-hmm. legal systems that don't account for any nuances or context or anything like that. I felt it was much more of a criticism that, and call me biased, because I feel like there are many systems that may be rigid for some people and not quite so rigid for others. Now, in this scenario, this is a system that is rigid uniformly for anybody and everybody, but that doesn't necessarily make it right. The quality of the rigidity and how harsh it is as a system doesn't make it any better. It's still a rigid system that should not be, or at least works for those people, but can't be applied to everybody. So I took it more of as an advocacy for flexibility and context in legal decisions. And maybe that's taking it a little bit too more in depth, but I really got more of a criticism of their unwillingness to bend from this is the law, this is the way, blah, 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 blah. And less so anti-death penalty. I mean, I'm not saying it's not against the death penalty at all. There's an aspect of that as well. But I felt it was much more against rigid legal systems that never take anything in context. It's the letter of the law only. And that, I think, is a little bit of a departure from normal Star Trek, because Star Trek typically lives and dies, or at least the Federation typically lives and dies by its regulations. And I feel like it's just that this is called justice, because it's not necessarily about the letter of the law being followed being justice. It's about what is the right thing to do here, which one is justice.
Right. One of the things that I really appreciate about The Next Generation in particular is, despite the fact that it's like late 80s, early 90s, they put issues at the forefront of the stories through these trials. And what they do a really good job at, the writers do generally, even in ones that, you know, I think the writers even say that they disliked the writing of.
Right.
They actually do a pretty good job of helping us develop and flesh out our characters. Like, look at Sins of the Father, for instance, just talking TNG still. That's an episode, and just so everybody we're on the same page, is one where Worf discovers through his brother, who he just discovered that he had, that the Klingon Empire has labeled his father a traitor. And Worf goes to the Klingon homeworld of Kronos and stands in front of the Klingon High Council in order to challenge the lies that he sees spoken about his father. Now, we think, okay, this is going to be Worf speaking about his father, and I'm, you know, in very much TNG fashion. Nothing really plays out in the course of this that's not any different than many other kinds of stories like this. What we see here is that when the truth is found and it turns out that Worf's father is indeed not the traitor, but instead another member of the Klingon High Council, his family is in fact responsible for betraying the Klingon Empire, the politics prove to be the greater situation. It subverts our whole notion of this monolithic Klingon culture being all about honor, and honor is subverted for political power than to service the truth.
And just a note on this one, it seems like this is maybe the first time we've really seen the Klingons willing to trade in on their honor for the sake of politics or gain of any other type.
And not the only time we'll see it either. I mean, there are actually quite a few of these trial episodes include Klingons.
And this is sort of the beginning of a trend where politics can influence anything, even the most highly held, deeply emotional values that you may have.
Very true. You know, one of the things, speaking of, I mean, there's just so many of them with TNG. You want to talk about not necessarily politics subverting things, but in the episode The First Duty, where Wesley Crusher, who is now off to Starfleet Academy at this point, involved in a training mission accident with his comrades in a flight accident with, basically, think of them as space F-14s doing, you know, an air show in space. And there's an accident. And the trial itself uncovers that there is a lie. And this lie is actually being perpetrated by someone that, for all intents and purposes, is a hero of ours. Wesley Crusher, the reason that he becomes a part of the lie is out of a sense of camaraderie or loyalty to his comrades within the Blue Angels, or whatever you want to call them, of Starfleet. Red Squad? First Squad?
Red Squad.
So Wesley is guilty in the end of this episode, and it's only when Wesley acknowledges and takes ownership of that. And it's interesting because the First Duty is actually structurally very similar to Sins of the Father. Those two episodes have a very similar thing. We hear that there's something that happened. We're very concerned. We're personally invested into our characters. The Worf one, we discover that Worf, from a story perspective, is actually making the right assumptions about his family's honor. We find out that Dr. Crusher and Captain Picard are making bad assumptions, or at least specifically even Dr. Crusher, about Wesley.
Right.
And that's somebody that we know. So, I mean, it's just like, it's a punch to the gut. It's like, Wesley's the liar here. He was the perfect kid, and that image is forever fractured.
And it's not often in terribly many shows of any franchise, much less Star Trek, that one of your hero characters, one of your recurring characters, is actually culpable for something quite so wrong.
Yeah.
Like openly and clearly lying, that's something that you don't see often of many of your heroes. Mm-hmm. Of course, he does face the consequences for that. Whether or not you think those consequences are valid or not, that's debatable. But he does face consequences for that. One of my favorite lines from that actually is when Wesley says, "I feel terrible." And in typical Picard fashion, he replies, "You should feel bad."
So one of the episodes that actually plays interestingly into this, Rules of Engagement is interesting because from a narrative standpoint, that episode is a combination of flashback and trial exposition. And
right.
It's the only episode I can think of, and if someone's out there or you've got one to correct me with, please do. It's the only episode I can think of where characters actually address the camera directly. They're not speaking to someone right to the right or left of camera. It's straight to camera.
Hmm.
That was directed by LeVar Burton, by the way.
That is, yes. Also, I'd like to point out, I think you're correct on that. Somebody can, you know, feel free to let us know. But also, I'd like to point out that directed by LeVar Burton, and the three main characters that you see in that episode are all black males, all black male actors.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ron Canada, Avery Brooks, and obviously Michael Dorn, all doing what could basically be a Broadway production. For me, that's a huge part of the appeal of that episode.
I was just going to say Ron Canada is so good in that.
He is excellent. Like, he's so good you want him to come back for some reason. This is a subtle part of world building in stories. Like, you've never heard of a Klingon lawyer.
No, ever.
But combine the aesthetics of what you know about a lawyer and combine the aesthetics of what you know about a Klingon, and they really kind of go hand in hand.
Rules of Engagement, that episode is a trial investigation about whether or not Worf was justified in firing on a cloaked Klingon civilian transport ship.
Worf is accused of this crime. There is a trial that is held on Deep Space Nine. Captain Sisko is his representative, or Jadich, if you prefer. The judge is a Vulcan admiral, and the trial is about whether or not Worf is to be extradited to the Klingon Empire to be held trial for this crime.
Interestingly enough, the prosecutor, he doesn't debate the facts of the story. There's no debate of the facts. This
right.
trial isn't even about facts. It's about what's inside someone's heart. We find out that, you know, his whole argument is to prove to the court that Worf's heart is Klingon, and only Klingons can judge another Klingon's heart.
I know we've talked before about another series that I grew up on, Law and Order, that you hadn't really watched much at all.
No.
One thing I can tell you, I will clarify that I prefer the classic, the original Law and Order more than any of the other subsidiaries or spinoffs. That said, for Law and Order, for me, a part of the appeal was it was almost like the law for high schoolers. Right. Like, this is how the law is supposed to work. Even if in the episode you see it didn't work out that way, you get an idea of this is what was supposed to happen. And I feel like a lot of the Star Trek trial episodes, with some of the exceptions that we've mentioned, kind of follow that trend. Like, this would be ideally how a trial takes place. Of course, you cut out some of the more boring parts like voir dire, if you prefer, and other filing motions and things like that. But in this one, Rules of Engagement, I felt like you really got more towards a little bit more what trials feel like, because sometimes a trial is not at all about the facts. It is about, this is what they sometimes call mens rea, which is the thought or the idea of killing, where it's not necessarily about, to summarize, and anybody who's a legal expert out there, please feel free to correct me and challenge me. But mens rea is basically kind of, it has to do with motive. Did you have the motive to kill? And so that's primarily what this episode is about. Did Worf had the motive or the idea or the mentality of killing? Was that it was killing somebody on his mind? And that makes this very unique. And I feel like that sets this apart from more of the kind of textbook legal stuff we've seen, especially when we get some of those great scenes between Ron Canada and Avery Brooks, where they're kind of verbally sparring with each other about what their intentions are and how Ron Canada intends to introduce evidence that was never seen before. I felt like this was much more in a typical Deep Space Nine fashion, like, yeah, you've seen the trials before. Now let's darken this up a bit and show you a little bit more of the uglier side of things.
Worf is supposedly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Klingon civilians, except that it turns out through some surprise circumstances, I'm not sure how much I buy this as a device as much as it allows us as the audience to let Worf off the hook for being this terrible person in that moment. Basically, everything points to Worf, and even Chief O'Brien has essentially, you know, testified that even he would take a different course of action if he were captain in place of Worf. The episode lets Worf off the hook because it turns out that that transport is empty. From a writer's perspective, it makes sense. It's like, okay, we're going to explore this notion that only a Klingon can judge a Klingon's heart. We're going to push Worf right to the edge, and we do all of these things. Except one thing that probably the writers looked at is, great that we did all this, but now
he has most definitely committed a war crime.
And then we're let off the hook, fortunately, by the fact that it turns out that that ship was actually empty, and that it was a ploy by the Klingon command to ensure that there is an accident that occurs and that the Federation and Starfleet would be held responsible and help usher in some greater conflict or situation. At least Sisko is apt to point out, he's like, you're damn lucky that no one died.
Right. I will say that seeing a captain curse somebody out finally was exceptional, especially it's Avery Brooks doing it. I thought that that was really kind of one of the centerpiece moments of the episode, where here's someone telling him, like, this is exactly what you did wrong. You don't often see that in Star Trek unless it's like specifically a training exercise or something like that. Obviously, you have the First Duty, where Picard does that a little bit with Wesley. We mentioned how you said you should feel bad. But this one was specifically like a dressing down from superior commander to subordinate. You don't often see that for literally more than 30 seconds in Star Trek.
And as much as we've talked about these episodes where we're debating these moral implications, and these episodes, they do vary in their structure and the way that they spell out these stories, I actually find the ones that have a little bit different structure, aside from rules of engagement, they tend to be ones that are really questioning about ourselves. We talked a little about court-martial and how much they, you know, you mentioned how they really pack it all in there at the beginning, kind of set this thing up, and it's all this about revenge between Kirk and Finney. Well, we also have a very ingenious use of court trial, the original reason being because they were running out of money and time in the original series, and Gene Roddenberry's like, wait, we got this pilot sitting on a shelf, maybe we can turn it into two episodes. There's a trial in the menagerie, but let's face it, the trial is just so that we can watch this old footage. You can stretch it and say there's some moral things to it and whatever, but structurally, this thing is designed to be a flashback story. The implications in the end are pretty much moot because we discover that the entire trial was an illusion, you know, devised to make Kirk and us watch the cage.
This is one of television's earliest clip shows.
Yes, it is. It got some award recognition for its time. Very different from the TNG clip show Shades of Grey.
Oh, dear Lord. Now, we kind of have to forgive them a little bit for that because that was during a writer's strike, if
I recall correctly. It was. But still, it was oof.
And our hero again is let off the hook for the consequences of their actions.
Exactly. And that's a theme of a lot of this. It's like they're actually not responsible for what they're accused, or they're let off the hook. In fact, the only episode that I can think of that somebody is not let off the hook and punished to the full scope of things is a Voyager episode called Distant Origin. And which on premise is probably one of the most bizarre trial episodes of all of these. Distant Origin purports that there is a race of, and I'm just going to say dinosaurs.
Yeah.
There's a race of dinosaurs. You heard that right. That originally evolved on Earth and have managed to travel across the galaxy. What we're talking about here, for anyone who's not initiated into this, the Delta Quadrant is at high warp velocities, decades, possibly even a century away from Earth, depending on how fast you travel. The episode is under the assumption that dinosaurs not only evolved on Earth, they developed spacecraft and traveled across the galaxy and relocated to the other side of the galaxy and have now discovered their home land on Earth. And I guess there's another story in there somewhere. But this preposterous idea is interesting because it allows us to actually have a very serious topic discussion about evolution, looking at the viewpoint of the stories that we tell ourselves about the origin of our existence. It's the very rare case that both the prosecution and the defense of this trial are both alien.
You're right. Yeah.
And that is, and it's the only one, and basically we have Chakotay in the episode who's basically brought in as sort of a witness slash advocate for the defense, but he's not on trial. He's, you know, as soon as the thing is over, it's basically like, okay, we're going to send them back. But the key thing is that the defense is punished because he's a scientist and he wants to go public with his findings and tell all the people that. And then the trial jury, or the judge, I should say, leader of this dinosaur race, decides that him being jailed for his crime is not enough. He must renounce his discovery and claim it's all fake, because what they're more interested in is maintaining the status quo of society, you know, which is a theme we've seen again, like we said, in Sins of the Father and elsewhere. These trials are about revealing or helping to obfuscate a truth. And this is the one time we see a trial episode where the truth is basically revealed, the truth is held in contempt, and serious punishment is issued towards the defense.
Right. Now, I will say this. We obviously we don't talk a lot about Enterprise. And in this context, Enterprise only had one episode that was a trial episode. I hadn't seen it in its original run. So when I recently rewatched it, I found it a little bit interesting. So it's the kind of thing I may not have given Enterprise credit for at the time. But as I'm looking back over it, it specifically is about not necessarily about finding truth, but about forcing truth into a corrupt system. In this one, the crew of the Enterprise in X-01, under Captain Archer, they encounter basically a group of people who are starving and hungry and decide to help them. The Klingon Empire considers this a crime and that they were helping rebels. Those rebels are literally just starving people under the control of the Empire. Captain Archer is arrested as being supportive of a rebellion against the Empire. And the episode, the meat of it really is the actual trial, where Archer's attorney, his defense attorney, is someone who goes from being kind of a willing lapdog, willing to go along with the corruption that he sees every day. And in the end, you might think like, oh, he becomes a freedom fighter or he changes things. No, he doesn't. He just agrees to stay. Spoiler alert, Archer is found guilty, but because his efforts actually wound up helping the Klingon Empire, or at least that's what his attorney is able to argue, he's not sentenced to death, which, again, here's the goes that Klingon death penalty thing. Instead, he's sentenced to a life imprisonment on Rurapente, which is a Klingon prison planet that we would have first seen in Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country. It is basically an ice planet where you can only survive underneath it. At the end of the episode, Archer's crew is able to rescue him, and they're about to rescue his Klingon attorney. I think his name is Kolos or something to that effect. And Kolos says, no, I'm going to stay. I have 1 year at Rurapente. After that, I'm going back into the system to work and reform it. And this is done knowing that almost no one survives a full year alive on Rurapente, even underneath the surface, the conditions are that harsh. So I found it interesting that this was an episode where you don't get a super happy ending. You know, the truth is revealed, but it doesn't actually save the day. All of the solutions are kind of found extrajudicially.
A little bit of fan service there is that trial is set up almost exactly to look like the one from Undiscovered Country.
Right. There was a lot of Easter eggs and fan service in that one. The entire courtroom scene is basically copy from Undiscovered Country, which, you know what? I can accept that if you want to say that this is the continuity of the Klingon legal system. Fine. It begins as one where it's just a setup to debate something. And then you're kind of disappointed at first because all you're debating is whether or not, you know, it's this sort of Rashomon style story where the characters sort of replay the events or re-describe the events from multiple different perspectives. And it's not all that different from what we've seen before. And then it shifts into a completely different thing. And it's no longer about the trial because both characters sort of accept that we're not going to win this.
Right.
All we can do is to make sure that the truth is known.
Speaking of trial episodes and points of view, Matter of Perspective from TNG. It's one of the episodes that, quite frankly, it does, you know, we were talking about, we always try to walk away from these stories feeling good about our characters and everything. It honestly is one that, to me at least, you walk away and I'm not quite sure how I feel about Riker when this thing is over. I guess that's part of it. You know, we're talking about the Rashomon storytelling. You know, each point of view that's told. This episode in this case is Riker is accused of essentially murdering a scientist on this space station, that somehow the station is destroyed just as he is being transported away, beamed away from the station to the Enterprise. And there's an accusation that, in fact, this is all some sort of revenge on Riker's part for various reasons that are put out there. One of them being that Riker had a romantic encounter with the scientist's wife. And then we're seeing points of view from these encounters that Riker had and confrontation with the scientists. And, you know, it's interesting and it's entertaining to a certain degree. And it's interesting, I mean, there's actually a moment in there where Counselor Troy, who's telepath, admits that these people are indeed telling their truth. They're not lying. This is how they see it, just as, you know, and it's just as right. Riker believes that he's telling the truth. And again, given that Trek trope of they're technically let off the hook, because turns out the guy actually tried to murder Riker himself and his attempt literally backfires on him and blows up his station.
Right.
Funny enough, that episode is actually one of those episodes where, as I understand it, the entire writing staff for The Next Generation collaborated on that script, and they each took parts of it and wrote it and rewrote it. And it was a complete mess. And it was an entire staff effort to get that episode in. It's actually one of the episodes that I've heard Ira Stephen Bear, showrunner for Deep Space Nine and writer on Next Generation, considers one of the worst writing efforts that he was a part of with Star Trek.
I mean, it's definitely not going to go down in history as one of the best written of all time. I did sort of appreciate the concept of using holograms or the holodeck or whatever to reenact different perspectives of the murder scene. I appreciated the fact that, like you mentioned, how Troy is saying, like, they're not lying. This is what they believe. And that is a legal thing where you have witnesses who can testify and they're 100% dead wrong, but they're not at all lying. That's what they believe. As a matter of fact, there are some political and media figures who cannot actually be or successfully be sued just because you can't prove that they didn't lie. They can just say that that is what they believe.
Right. And maybe this got lost in all the writers. We saw Riker's point of view in the episode. We saw the scientists. Mm-hmm. Dr. Apgar is his name. We see Dr. Apgar's assistant, her point of view. We get, I think his wife's name was Minuet. Not Minuet, but like Manuet or something like that. I'm sure somebody can correct my pronunciation there. We get her point of view as well. So we get those three points of views. But one of the point of views that I find that we don't get in any of these reenactments, and it's just maybe it's just me, but the first sign that we had that there was some trouble on the station actually comes from Geordi. And so Geordi was on the station and witnessed some things, but we never are treated to seeing Geordi's point of view of what happened.
Well, I mean, even when I saw this episode when I was younger, the first thing that came to my mind was, does this station have no security cameras?
Yeah, well, I guess it's a science station, so maybe it's, you know, you can't have cameras too close. I mean, then again, why are you beaming next to a, you know,
next to a volatile experiment in the first place? Yeah.
If you can't even put a security camera there. Yeah. But again, you're right. I mean, this is one where we get a holo recreation, and it's kind of nice because, you know, there's lots of times that trial episodes we tend to get flashbacks, and how the flashbacks are told or, you know, varies by story. But this is one where we actually get to witness recreations of it. So we're not treated to devices where we're being spoon-fed the director's vision of what the character sees. We're being shown specifically what the character believes they saw. In the end, you know, I kind of like that we're kind of left in the end going, we really don't know the truth.
That's a good point. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
So
fascinating.
Since we have talked a little bit about Discovery, I think it's important that we talk about Unification Part 3. Again, for those who haven't seen it, or for those who have seen it and you need a reminder, it's a Season 3 episode of Discovery, still actually releasing now, where we're treated not to a trial of the sorts that we've seen. It's not really a trial about where our morals are at stake at the very heart of the story, but we're giving something that's the first time we get a Vulcan inquiry system that's now being done on Navar, which is the now merged planet for the Vulcan and Romulan civilizations. We get this inquiry that Burnham invokes when they arrive, trying to uncover the mystery of the Burn, which is the big mystery of Discovery Season 3. What's interesting here is that we're once again treated to that second type of Star Trek trial episode, which is the trial episode that is more about revealing stuff about a character. It's more about revealing truths.
Right.
It's not so much about some sort of moral dilemma. And that's what I think that this one really comes across as. What we're looking at is an episode where Burnham is struggling with where she belongs in the world. And this trial, unlike previous trial episodes, which are trials that unveil things about a character's state within the trial, this trial is unveiling stuff about Burnham outside of the trial itself. And it's kind of like we've set up a trial so that we just have a reason to force Burnham to spit out the truth about herself.
Yeah, so I mean, I love that discovery. I sometimes love the approach that they take, which is to go more of an interpersonal emotional route. And that is to say, what is the emotional state of this character and how do these events affect them interpersonally? That said, there's a moment in the trial situation where Burnham is offering her truth outside of the trial. And I just have to wonder to myself, if I was a Vulcan, you know, member of the tribunal, I'm standing there wondering, why am I listening about your personal life? Yeah. I don't care if you're happy with Starfleet or not. I don't really give a damn if you're telling the truth about that. That's not why I came in here. In almost every other type of trial that we've seen, there is a procedure. Whether it's a Klingon trial or a Cardassian trial, there are rules that are laid out for you. I still don't really know what the rules of this Vulcan trial were, other than you make an argument, people will disagree with your argument. I don't know who was the judge. I don't know who had the final say. Those rules are never given. A huge part for me of the tradition of Star Trek of these are the rules of the trial, and now we're going to play with those rules, are jettisoned out for this confessional. And I felt like if the point of this were a confessional, then she could have had that moment with her mother, who is a part of the Kawat Milat now.
It was a little convenient.
Yeah, it's a little bit convenient. But her mother is now dedicated to absolute candor. You could have had this moment with her any time outside of this trial. And again, I have to ask myself, if I'm a Vulcan there, I'm wondering, why am I listening to your personal
Well,
life?
My other question is, from looking at it from a writer's perspective, did somebody just say we wanted to have a trial episode? I just wonder if there was another way they could go about it, or whether or not this in the end came down to somebody just saying, we want to have a show trial. We want to have a trial.
I really think it's the latter. I really think it was we got to have a trial episode, just because if you're going to have a trial and your judge or judges are people devoted towards logic, she made a really, really emotional appeal based upon their Christ figure at this point, which is basically Spock, who, having succeeded in uniting the Vulcan and Romulan people, is now kind of revered. It's the one thing that gets her into the door after they have shut the door on the Federation.
Yeah. The writing for New Trek, of course, is obviously contemporary. And one of the things that at least I seem to notice throughout all of it is that there is more of an emphasis on getting from point A to point B as quickly as we can and keeping things exciting. And they're just, I wonder really about exploring who these characters really are. Like, even in the end, we have Burnham revealing how she really feels about Starfleet, how she really feels about belonging. And Sonequa Martin-Green is so good at it that she's so good that you only on rewatch realize the writers failed to make it clear to me why Burnham wants to stay in Starfleet. I literally had to watch it a second time to go, wait a second, she actually doesn't explain it.
Yeah, it's something her mother says about duty and joy. And as soon as that speech is over, I literally said out loud,
yeah,
what?
Yeah,
what does it mean?
I don't, it's really perplexing to me because it is really the one time where at the end of an episode of one of these trial episodes, we're left sitting there going, I don't know what we resolve. And I don't know what it was trying to tell me.
Right. I mean, I get that we now know the status of the Vulcan and Romulan people. And we now have the MacGuffin that we needed to continue the overarching mystery. We now know emotionally where our main character is. Apart from serving those masters, I have no idea what this episode is about.
And that's the weird thing to me about this, is that I don't know what was really the turning for Burnham. I don't know what really compelled the Vulcan president or Navarre president to turn over the information. What was specifically compelling?
And even if it's a situation, because knowing Romulans, they may say, hey, if you're going to be making important decisions, I demand on being there. Sure. You're not going to make them without me. That scans with Romulans. Give me a 1 minute scene where I see the Romulan leader saying, no, I'm going to be on this tribunal too.
Or in fact, give me something where, you know, they're one of the Vulcan leaders on the tribunal says, you know, you're trying to appeal to us with emotion regarding Spock. And I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, you have Romulans there. They have an emotional side to them. Did they all of a sudden become like Vulcans? What exactly is your defensive point there? I mean, if I'm just assuming that everybody there is Vulcan, that's one thing. That seems to carry a lot of weight. But, and that was the thing that I guess bothered me the most, is that one was really muddy.
And then also, when you think about those cultures, Romulan and Vulcan, this should have been a real great challenge episode and a showcase for Sonequa, because she has to convince the most logical people in the galaxy and the most suspicious people in the galaxy. Yes. So one is going to question everything she says, and the other one is going to doubt everything she says. This should have been a razzle-dazzle episode of dialogue.
You know, we didn't even get to talking about Measure of a Man or the Drumhead. I mean, are... You know, I'm sure we can find a reason to discuss those episodes in some future time. But I really do think that those episodes, just to touch on them briefly without going into them, those are just absolute masterclasses in Star Trek writing and character development. You know, the only reason we buy this episode Unification is because Sonequa Martin-Green is so good. And again,
exactly.
This is, you know, you and I have talked about this at length. She is the reason this show is any good in the end, because she takes things that should not carry any water and would have been laughed at in earlier eras of Star Trek. And she makes it believable enough that at least the first time through, you're like, okay. And then you watch the episode again, you're like, wait a second. Now that I've kind of, you know, I'm not razzle-dazzled by your performance, I'm now starting to realize that the writing here was actually pretty bad.
I would say that Sonequa is brilliant. I think that the entire cast, their performances, they are holding this thing up. And this is not, you know, I think that Mary Wiseman, Anthony Rapp, I think that all of these actors, Doug Jones does everything he does in Heroes, for goodness sake. You know, I think that this is a phenomenal cast. I think that they are the glue that holds that entire series together. And yeah, I kind of do feel like the writing sometimes fails them, because with this caliber of cast, this should be class. When I say classic Trek, I don't necessarily mean it should resemble the past. I mean, we should be seeing new classics.
We should. And I have to say, in the end, after all these trials, does any of this make any sense?
Right.
Story Trek is brought to you by no one still. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can interact with us there with story_Trek. Hopefully we'll be turning this around, that in the next week we will have another journey to go on with you, and we'd love for you to tune in and listen.
Feel free to respond to us in any way you like. Tell us your favorite court episodes. And as he said, reach back out to us. Look out for our next episode that should be coming. Is it going to come next week?
I don't know. We'll let you guys know. Follow us on Twitter. You'll find out.
All right, guys, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our talk. Signing off, this is Marshall LLAP.
And I'm Michael Sturdygakis. Live long and prosper.